Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Americans have knit and purled their stress away through many a tough time, picked up the needles and churned out socks and scarves and sweaters and hats. Now in the age of the internet, Wi-Fi, and high technology, knitting, of all things, is back. Look around, on the bus, at Starbucks, in the bleachers. Those are young adults and grandmas knitting. Why? Why now? What search for nature or calm or community or something material to do has brought back knitting? This hour on Point, of all things, knitting. You can join the conversation. Is that you with the needles flying? Why? And why now? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Chicago is Susan Strawn, Associate Professor of Apparel Design and Merchandising at Dominican University, and author of Knitting America, A Glorious Heritage from Warm Socks to High Art. Susan Strawn, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on your program.
It's just great to have you here. And also with us from Chicago is Franklin Habit. His blog, The Panopticon, is one of the most popular knit blogs in the country. Franklin Habit, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Susan Strawn, let me come first to you. What's going on with this? We put out the word that we were going to do a show on knitting. And, you know, it seemed like in seconds, our Facebook and web were full of comments saying, Yahoo, yay, thank you. This is a big deal to me. You know, knitting is huge. And these aren't just, you know, maybe the image of grandmas. These are all kinds of people knitting. What's going on?
Well, I think you put your finger on it. The social media has made it possible for knitters to be in touch with one another in ways that they never could in the past. I think knitting has been intrinsically a social activity as well as a solitary activity. And it's just made it possible for us to be together, sometimes alone together, through Ravelry, through the blogs.
Ravelry is a website, kind of a Facebook for knitters online.
Exactly, but more. But
surely
we're all connected through Ravelry.
Right, okay. We'll talk about how that works, but surely it's, I mean, social media can fire up all kinds of things, but they only fire up things that people are in the mood for one reason or another to do.
True.
You've said that knitting has kind of come and gone in American history. Describe those waves for us. How was knitting seen? This wasn't seen as the sort of high use. I mean, this wasn't crocheting or needlepoint. This was sort of the more humble cousin, and it's come and gone. When and why?
Well, it's always been very utilitarian, very practical. And when I was researching my book, I found that during times when the nation is particularly stressed, that there is a definite increase in the amount of knitting and in the number of people knitting.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, World War I, World War II, the Civil War, millions of new knitters coming into the fold. But perhaps more surprisingly was during the Great Depression, the 1930s, knitting was as popular, as widespread as it is today. And there seems to be something about those times when people turn to knitting as a more joyful and rewarding type of activity. It's my own experience. I find knitting kind of holds my life together.
We started calling it finger yoga around here in the last couple of days as we looked into this. I mean, people doing it, Franklin, you may have a sense of what I'm talking about, but an awful lot of people, we see this in the web comments, saying it not only lets me create something material. In an age where my job is all, you know, digital impulses flying off, you can never lay a hand on it, but you can lay a hand on a scarf or socks or a hat, but also a kind of a meditative practice, of all things, Franklin, in knitting.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, my own knitting experience goes back to college in the mid-90s when I learned from a classmate of mine. And at the time, it was I was attracted to the cozy anachronism of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I came back to knitting in a strong way years after that because I was working in electronic marketing and fairly miserable and working entirely in things that I could not touch or embrace or feel. And at the end of the day, I would have not much to show for my labor except a filled-in database or a couple of website pages. With knitting, I was able to create something that there was the pleasure in the creating, and then there was the feeling, especially in Chicago in winter, of doing the 3-mile walk from the train station to my office at the time and knowing that I was being kept warm by a hat that I had made for myself. It was a really nice collision between creativity and practicality.
And so there you are off with it. And now who would have thunk it? But a blogger, a kind of internet sensation writing about this, what we shear from sheep and turn into hats and socks. Mm-hmm. I mean, Susan Strawn, there's clearly a kind of hunger here that's bringing this back. You say times of stress. We've just been through a big economic downturn. But even before that downturn began, I think knitting was sort of on its way back in the last more than a decade now. So it didn't just happen with the crash of 08, right?
Not at all. Some people attribute it to kind of after effects of the Twin Towers disaster, mm-hmm. but it really had started before that. And I think we have to, on a practical basis, give some credit to the Craft Yarn Council, which is the trade organization for the yarn manufacturers. And I think part of the success is the determination of the yarn manufacturers to provide a truly sensational a range of yarns that are very stimulating and very interesting. And in addition to the commercial companies, we have across the country hundreds, if not thousands, mm-hmm. of small producers that are providing very specialized yarns. So there's always something new to learn there. So it's very stimulating, very interesting. And when you always have a little trouble when people talk about knitting as yoga, and perhaps I just don't understand yoga. But for me, knitting is a very intellectual activity. Mm. Most of the people I know who are serious knitters are also highly accomplished people. I'm thinking of a federal judge who's a very serious knitter who I know. And
maybe you should try some yoga. Our listeners here are full of this kind of reference, too. Yes, you've got to pay complete attention, which means you have to be completely centered and focused on what you're doing. Your mind can't be flying across. You may be thinking a lot of things, but at some level, you're be here now. You're in the moment mm-hmm. when you're knitting, mm-hmm. I guess.
That's true. And there's also something about when I worked at Interweave Press for quite a while, and Linda Ligon, the woman who is the who founded Interweave Press, said something I think quite profound, which was that we may not need these products any longer. I mean, you can go to Penny's, you know, Franklin, mm-hmm. for example, you could have gone to Penny's and
sure.
bought a hat.
Of course.
But there's something about what we need the process mm-hmm. and what we've lost in so much of our lives is process. Mm-hmm. And that to me was such a profound insight and something that I've carried with me and that has reinforced my notion that knitting is worthy of scholarly activity, worthy of study, worthy of a great deal of attention.
It's interesting looking at this wonderful book, and we've got a great photo gallery up at our website, onpointradio.org, but in your book, Knitting America, you've got posters from the wartime, World
yes.
War II and World War I, where women yes. at home are being very explicitly urged to knit, big posters saying, "Our boys need socks. Knit your bit." I guess that was the phrase.
Right.
Here's mm-hmm. another one that, you know, that shows what it looks like, a sailor off at sea and a wife or mother at home. "Knit a bit for our first line of defense. Wool, needles, yes. and directions." The boys need hats and socks. And for a time in war, they actually got them from people knitting them at home, Susan.
Yes, they did. I think my favorite poster is the one, "Remember Pearl Harbor, Pearl Harder."
As in P-U-R-L, knit harder almost, right?
Knit harder, yeah, Pearl Harder.
Right.
Absolutely. And during wartime, women on the home front, it gives them a way to feel that they're supporting people in a very intimate way. They can send an object, a piece of their material culture, if you will, that has in which every strand of yarn has been through their fingers, has touched human hands. And I think knitters want to believe, and I think it's true for good reason, that when they knit something and they give it to someone, that everything they put into that piece is there and is being transferred to that person, and that's the intention. And it helps them feel that they're supporting.
I've got a little clip here from World War II days when citizens on the home front were encouraged to, you know, knit their bit, knit for victory, scarves and socks. And here's a clip from a veteran, Irvin Davis, who remembers getting a home knit sweater while serving abroad. It's from the Your Stories project by St. Louis Television, KETC.
The girls in school would knit. They'd knit sweaters for the boys in service. And later, I always laughed about the girls knitting sweaters for the boys in service, because eventually, when I was sent overseas, I was given a sweater. You know, the Red Cross would distribute the sweaters. And I, sure enough, I got a sweater, and one sleeve was real long and one sleeve was short, and all the stitches were, there were a lot of dropped stitches in the sweater. But I knew that somebody was very, very dedicated to the war effort.
Somebody was home. Somebody was doing it. Franklin, who's doing it for whom today? Are people knitting clothing or artwork? Are they doing it for their families? We're reading about what's called yarn bombing here, a kind of knitting graffiti going on. What happens with all that stuff getting knitted out there at Starbucks on the bus today?
It's all of the above. You have folks who knit entirely for themselves, the so-called, you know, quote-unquote selfish knitters, which I love that. There's actually an entire group of people who just identify, I'm a selfish knitter. You have the people who do it for lack of a better term, pure art, who do the things like knitted graffiti or knitted installations and galleries. And then you have sort of the workaday knitters like myself. I do socks for myself. I do an awful lot of clothes for a four-year-old niece who has me wrapped around her little finger. And I actually do a lot of things for, it goes back to what Susan was talking about with the joy of the process. I knit a lot of lace, and that's not something I wear. It's something I knit because I love it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking, of all things this hour, about knitting and how and why one of the oldest handcrafts has made a comeback in the age of high-tech, Wi-Fi, and ready-made everything. Susan Strawn joins us from Chicago, author of Knitting America, A Glorious Heritage from Warm Socks to High Art. Franklin Habit joins us from Chicago as well. He's one of the most prominent knitting bloggers in the country. His blog is the Panopticon. He's also got the Thousand Knitters Project, photographing 1,000 knitters at their work. We've got all kinds of response online here. People saying, yay, it's about time you covered this. the world is endlessly diverse out there. Here's Jess, Susan, speaking to the yoga business. She's saying, one of the goals of a meditation practice is to bring you into a calm focus, to quiet the noise of your mind. The nature of knitting is such that you need to pay attention to your work, or else you'll drop stitches or knit when you should have purled. And there she's off. You're focusing almost like during meditation. Leah writes, knitting has infinite possibility. It's a hobby. It's a lifestyle. It's a solid way to tell someone you love them with 10,000 stitches. Ellen says, knitting is more than a hobby for many of us. It's a way of exercising our minds, to your point. Mm-hmm. Meditating, there it is again, with color and fiber, even making a statement on our current societal situations. Let's get our listeners right in here. Here's a call from Westford, Vermont, and India. India, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. And hi, Franklin. I read your blog every day.
All right.
Thank you.
I've been knitting passionately and constantly for over 20 years, and I could talk for a long time on all the reasons why I knit and what I love about knitting. But I'd like to mention in particular the good that knitters do. There's all kinds of charity knitting for preemies in hospitals, for cancer patients. Some people knit wool helmet liners for our soldiers. There's knitting for the homeless and many others. And spurred on by Stephanie Pearl McPhee, also known as the Yarn Harlot, who's a best-selling
The Yarn Harlot. Blogger. Yes, I love that. Yeah.
Knitters have raised over $1 million for Doctors Without Borders. And right now there's an ongoing campaign called Warm Hats, Not Hotheads, which is a knitters campaign to encourage civility in our political discourse. It was started by a couple of knit bloggers, Ellen Silva and Allison Hyde.
How does it work, India?
Pardon me?
How does it work?
The idea is to get as many knitters as possible from all points on the political spectrum to knit hats and send them to our senators and representatives in Congress as a way of urging them to stop all the nasty rhetoric and get down to the business of solving problems for us.
That's great. What's it called again?
Warm Hats, Not Hotheads.
Okay. The Knitters Speak.
There's a group on Ravelry. There's a group on Facebook. We are going to, some people will encourage their representatives to donate hats to charity so this warmth will spread. Others may choose to keep the hats because I think, as your guest said, there is a plea for civility and thanks for their service knitted into every stitch in those hats.
That's fantastic. Warm hats, not hot heads, a kind of knitter's call for civility in our political discourse even.
Absolutely. There's actually a lot of ways that a hat is a good analogy for civil discourse. I probably don't have time to go into it here, but we do encourage people, if they're interested, to check out Facebook and Ravelry.
That's terrific. India, thank you very much for your call. That's really great. I mean, this, the community aspect of this, whether it's online or in person, took me back as I was looking into this for today's show, Susan Franklin. I mean, I remember our family lore from ancestors who settled the Midwest, you know, almost a couple hundred years ago now, was they would the women would go to quilting bees, and they'd get home, be walking home so late, they would carry pine knots, you know, blazing through the woods to keep the wolves from coming after them. Now you've got knitters heading out there to knitting circles. Maybe that's where the call for civility in political discourse comes from, Susan, right up out of those knitting circles. I don't know.
And it's the knitting circles, but it also extends beyond the knitting circles in your own local community. You know, Franklin is heading out to Madrona Retreat
right.
in Tacoma.
Mm-hmm.
This weekend I attended it last year. And this, people come from all over the country to attend these knitting retreats. And I just was taking some notes here, and the word that came to mind was one thing had to do with being joyful. When mm-hmm. I go to attend, say, Madrona, for example, and there are other knitting camps, and other knitting gatherings. I was at one in the Shetland Islands last fall called In the Loop. Knitters from all over the world were there. And a couple years ago, it was the Sock Summit in Portland, Oregon, more than 3,000 sock knitters. There is a sense of joyfulness and camaraderie, mm-hmm. just happiness, learning new things and sharing that I have not found anywhere else.
Franklin,
I agree with that.
Yeah, does it come back from this? You know, we're told that we're in this fragmented age when everybody's out there, I don't know, watching mm-hmm. Facebook alone at night.
Mm-hmm.
Here you can get together, either together or talk about it online, exactly mm-hmm. where you are with your knitting mm-hmm. project and what wool you've got available and who's
exactly.
got what now.
Exactly. That's right. And mm-hmm. that was the reason that it's not the reason I started blogging, but it's certainly the reason I stuck with it, is because a blog really is a dialogue. And that's mm-hmm. what I get to enjoy with the knitters who read my blog. I tell them what I'm up to. They tell me what they're up to. And if I had started to write something similar but in a more traditional format, like a newspaper column where there might be feedback but it wouldn't be quite so quick and direct,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'd stuck with it. Knitters love to talk about knitting, yarn, wool, all the impedimenta that go along with it. And
it is
the
sharing ideas.
Exactly.
There's a kind of yeah. instant bonding, mm-hmm. I find. If there had been somebody on the L this morning coming down into mm-hmm. the city from Oak Park, if there had been somebody knitting, I would have approached them and talked, and we probably would have mm-hmm. struck up at least a 10-minute friendship on there.
I'm actually going to Iceland to teach knitters in October. And I was a little worried about that. I have never been to Iceland, and my languages are limited to English, basically. And I said to the tour organizer, are you sure I'm a good fit for this? And she said, don't worry. We all knitters. That's all you need to know.
Knitters stick together, and they're all over the place. Here's a web comment from Mary in Lanesburg, Michigan. It says, oh, yeah, that was me at the MSU versus UM women's basketball game last Saturday. A full house of fans, and there I was knitting a sock before the game, and at halftime can't sit still. Sean from Nashville, Tennessee. Thanks for calling, Sean. You're on the air.
Hi.
Well, hi, Sean. Well, what's your story?
For me, I started knitting actually on 9/11. My husband was out of the country and just be on a flight home, and I was very nervous about what was going on, obviously. And a friend just who knits was over, and so she about her knitting and started to teach me. And I've used it since then, you know, when things are, you know, when you have to think a lot and there's a problem you're going through. It's kind of like a conversation with myself. it helps me relax. It it also produces something at the end, which is really good, instead of just nervous energy that, you know, produces nothing. This produces something, and it's just been a great way for me. And I never thought I would have knit, been a knitter until that happened. But I've now taught my daughter and some other friends and stuff. So we have like a little knit group. But it did start with, you know, for me, that moment of just being very, very nervous. And it has always just calmed me down.
Mm-hmm. Right there on 9/11, Susan Strong, to your point, that's exactly where Sean began. In Nashville, I've got Julia here on Facebook. She says, I see the resurgence of knitting as a reconnection to a sense of craft in American life and to a kind of in-the-momentness not encouraged in our generation. Working with your hands is incredibly soothing. Creating something useful and beautiful is very satisfying. And the opportunity that knitting affords to add creative value to organic, earthy materials. She's got wool, alpaca, linen, cotton, unique in craft. I mean, people really yearning to be grounded. I want to listen to a little tape here from a guest who's just about to join us. This is of Jenna Wogenrich, and she's got the Cold Antler Farm in Vermont, sheep there that you can, I guess, kind of buy a share in their wool, and she'll get it out to you if you're a knitter. Here she is introducing her flock, Jenna Wogenrich.
So it's New Year's Eve here at the farm, and this is one of the new black faces and the parade of black faces by Maud and our good friend Sal and Joe back there. Joe's the mouthy one. But you can see they're all lined up waiting for hay. And they've made a trail go up to their little homes up there on the top of the hill. And they don't care for the snow, so they'll kind of stand in their own non-snowy area here they've made of hay they didn't find fit to eat. But, they seem to be comfortable. Hey, girls.
Jenna Wogenrich with her little flock there on Cold Antler Farm. She joins us right now from Manchester, Vermont. Jenna, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
So tell us what you're up to there. What exactly are you doing with your sheep, and how do you get from them bleating in the background, bleating, to wool on needles?
Well, it starts every spring. I'm going to actually be learning to shear this year at the Vermont Shelburne Farms Sheep Shearing Academy, which is a weekend course in the spring. But my flock is shorn in the spring, and then it gets sent off, most of it, to a wool mill, where people who have paid in advance for a CSA share get their wool returned, probably not until summer or fall. It takes a while to get wool back.
A CSA share. So this is like the gardens where you might sign up for a weekly box of vegetables, but instead it's a share in the wool from your sheep.
That's exactly right, and it's a very intimate situation where the people who follow the farm online on my blog, they can actually know the sheep by name. They can make a sweater. They're sending in projects online now and posting them, and they're naming the projects after the sheep that the wool came from. So it's a very different way to knit in a way that everything has a little more character. Everyone is a community built around these animals and the farm itself and what the farm goes through. So it's been just like a gardening CSA where you pay in advance for a share and you watch the farm go through its adventures. And then at the end of the harvest season, you get your package of wool.
You know, I grew up on a farm raising sheep, actually. I saw a picture somewhere, maybe on the web, of a pickup truck full of fleece just shorn from the sheep. That brings back a lot of memories of shearing. But that really tactile connection to the animal, when it's still got all the lanolin in it, still really got that earthy feel to it. And you can see it's almost like taking a coat off there, or six coats off, in the back of your pickup, Jenna.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I've been knitting for a while. I was a knitter before I was a farmer. And the process of going from someone who buys yarn in a store or goes to even meet a farmer and buy yarn from them, it's so different. I'm holding a hat in my hands that came from the sheep I raised. And so it's a very full circle situation. And just as it is making something from scratch, from the yarn to the needles to the hat, to know the sheep's first name and to be the one who's feeding it every day in a hat that they wore last season
right.
has been a fantastic situation. I'm in love with it.
Do you feel people wanting to get closer to the land is you know, coming to you for their wool, for knitting? Do you think that's part of what this is about, Jenna?
Absolutely. I think people are getting involved in all sorts of DIY projects, not so much because it's trendy or green, but because it feels really good to do it. To take responsibility for yourself in such a basic way has kind of been, I want to say, stolen away from our generation. I grew up with video games and microwaves, and I certainly don't come from a farming background, but to grow your own vegetables, to have your own chickens laying eggs, to learn how to make a sweater you grew in the backyard, it's definitely an incredibly rewarding experience that most folks are getting for the first time now, because they're kind of teaching themselves how to get back to it. And I'm fine with it being a fad, if that's what folks want to call it, but it's certainly getting people home in a brand new way.
It's funny how much people invest in it here, emotionally and in terms of bringing, I don't know, something to their life. Here's Jan. She writes online, "To knit is a powerful and empowering act. In an age where we deal so frequently with the transient and the intangible, knitting produces items of substance meant to be useful, to bring warmth, to show we care. It makes it very, very real." Let's go to Diana in Nashville, Tennessee. Diana, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great.
I love to knit. I've been giving myself back to people by knitting. We don't have a lot of money, and I get yarn on sale. And when we were in Denver in the wintertime, it was something to do while watching television. I would knit hats. And then the following winter, at the beginning of the winter, I would take those hats to the shelters. And they were wash and wear. I mean, people could have tossed them in the sink and wash them to wear them. And from there, I've gone on and I make hats for the women who have cancer and for the men who have cancer.
Now, you know, Diana, you could go down to Target or Kmart and buy a bunch of stocking caps for not very much money. So why knit them instead of just doing that?
I'm a fidgeter. I don't sit still. And I like to watch TV, but I don't sit still and watch TV. And instead of pacing back and forth, I was knitting. And it's something to give back. And, yeah, you could buy the cheap hats at Walmart, Kmart. But my hats were double strand, which means they were a lot warmer than what you could get at the store.
Diana, I really appreciate your call. That impulse to do something with the hands, Susan, and have it end up with somebody who really needs it. There's some sort of circle of satisfaction there that people are finding very materially here.
There absolutely is, and I think it speaks to values and reclaiming certain values we may have lost. I was thinking as Jenna was speaking, about my own grandparents and my grandmother who knew how to do all those things, kept chickens and so on, was a wonderful needle worker. And it was actually another grandmother who taught me to knit, but when I was very small. So it's always been part of my life and an important part of it. And it kept me through kind of an unhappy adolescence when I became obsessed around 12. And I've never given away that, never given up that obsession with knitting, because there's always something new to learn. But also there's the value aspect of it. I think it really does speak to wanting to reclaim some values that have been lost.
Is it cheaper to knit something than to buy it in the store, or the opposite?
Oh, no.
No. What, yarn is that expensive?
You know, it depends. You can find some yarn sometimes at economy shops or resale shops. You can find certain kinds of yarn, some of the big box stores that are relatively inexpensive. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, it's a slippery slope, and it's a short step to the edge of the cliff, and you want more.
Unless you have unlimited pockets, you quickly learn to become a bargain hunter.
Oh, boy.
Yes.
Oh, boy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about, of all things, knitting, and how and why one of the oldest handcrafts out there has made a comeback in the age of, what, high-tech and Wi-Fi and ready-made and earbuds. We've been joined by Susan Strawn at Dominican University, author of Knitting America, Franklin Habit. He's got the Panopticon, one of the big knitting blogs in this country these days. And Jenna Wogenrich, she's the operator and blogger for Cold Antler Farm in Vermont. She raises the sheep that bring the wool that the knitters put on the ends of their needles, ultimately. They're all with us. We're going to hear in just a moment from a... From a knitting graffiti artist in Oakland, California. I've got here's another web comment. We've got all kinds of gushy web comments coming in here. Oh my gosh, you know, it's so great to hear about knitting. It's about time somebody talked about it, long overdue. But here's another perspective for you, gang. Here's Gary. And he says, the urban progressives that think of themselves as forward free thinkers are actually backward followers, regress to knitting, regress to small farms, regress to walkable neighborhoods, regress to having chickens in your backyard, regress to not bathing regularly. He says, do not associate with anyone that will point out your BS. You're marching backwards, radicals. Off you go. I guess not everybody's on the bandwagon here, Franklin. It's all regression. Is that what you've got going on?
Well, I do bathe regularly, so I'm not sure what knitters he's hanging out with.
Jenna, what about it up there in Vermont? Gary's not on board here. He thinks you're marching backwards to the age of knitting and handcraft and maybe not bathing so regularly. I won't speak for you.
I do bathe regularly, I assure you. I think some folks do share that opinion. I think it's kind of scary when you start hearing about people doing things and learning to do things without the help of the economy. Well, that's not true. They're certainly getting help from the economy. They need to get the supplies. But a different economy. And if it's something you don't have the interest or drive or ever want to have to do for yourself, it gets scary when you hear about a bunch of folks kind of taking the reins and doing it for themselves. So I think that attitude is more one based out of shock and a little bit of underground fear more than anything involving regression. I think if he was really, really, really cold one day, he would happily put on one of our hats.
It is so funny that people in 2011 are looking back to this as a kind of maybe even a way of thinking about how we go forward. We visited the students of an after-school knitting class at the Chestnut Hill School outside Boston. Here's just a little clip of one of the students there, Lindsay. This is a very young American explaining how to do the basic knit stitch.
You take two needles and you have some stitches on a needle, and then you put your one needle through, and then you make an X, get your long string, not the short string, and then you wrap it around and pull it out.
That's pretty good. I don't know if it's the past or the future, but you can definitely hear it right now. Let's go to Norma in Glasgow, Kentucky. Hi, Norma. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
We have a group of women who crochet and knit for the battered women and children in Glasgow, in Bowling Green, Kentucky shelter. We started this in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
And we have about 12 active members. At the age of 66, I went back to college and I graduated at 71. I looked around for a volunteer job after I graduated, summa cum laude. Anyway.
Congratulations.
That's an accomplishment for 71. I'm legally blind in both eyes.
Oh, my.
But anyway, with the help of the Department of Blind, I did get through, and I did quite well. But I couldn't find anyone that would accept me, my volunteer work, because of my age. So I started my own group. We're called Willing Hearts and Hands. I have 12 active members. We knit and crochet caps, afghans, scarves, whatever. We also furnish towels, sheets, blankets, whatever the shelter.
For battered women's children. Norma, let me ask you, you say you're legally blind. How does that work? Is that an impediment to knitting or not?
I lost my sight, and I don't knit because of my sight.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to lose my stitches, but many of our ladies do knit lovely things. And we also hold a bazaar once a year to raise money. We raffle off of African, and that's how we're funded. Yarn has increased from $1.69 a skein up to $2.47. Mm-hmm. So it costs us a minimum of $15 for each African. But we provide warmth and comfort for these women who have been displaced due to domestic violence.
And Norma, what does it mean to you and your group that you're doing this by hand, knitting there together, creating these by hand instead of just going out to Walmart and buying them some blanket?
Because the quality is much better. The workmanship is much better. It doesn't ravel out after a washing. It endures. Some of the yarn is as good 20 years later as it was. I had a young grandson. I crocheted him a big afghan. When he was grown, 20 years later, he came back and he said, "Grandma, the big afghan you crocheted for me when I was little is now a little afghan because I'm big."
It's time to re-up. Norma, I love it. Thank you very much. Good luck to your group there, Willing Hearts, and thank you for your call from Glasgow. Let's get one more from Grand Ledge, Michigan. Suzanne, you're on the air, Suzanne.
Thank you, Tom. Your programs are always up and lifting for everybody. But just a little blurb that my father, who couldn't be in the World War II because of medical, did knit many socks and such for the soldiers. And I know there must have been many, many men out there doing the same.
So knit your bit. He was ready to do it. He couldn't be over there fighting, but he could make something from home.
Yes, sir.
I love it. Thank you, Suzanne. Thank you very much for your call. You know, knitting has gone a long way from knitting those hats and scarves for the troops these days. There's even a kind of knitting graffiti, if that's the right word for it, movement out there. We've got one of the folks who's doing that calling us right now from Oakland, California. I guess the street name here is Street Color, a self-entitled yarn bomber or knitting street artist. She puts up her colorful hand-spun pieces on parking meters and statues and street signs all around the Bay Area, spins and dyes her own yarn, designs and knits her pieces, and installs them right there in the street. Street Color in Oakland, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What are you up to when you're tagging the world with your knitted work? What's that about?
What am I up to? I do think that streets look a lot better with knitting on them. Knitting lets you put a tremendous amount of color out on the street in this very benign, soothing way that people will accept in a way that they wouldn't accept if I was spray painting.
And for example, it might be around the signpost that suddenly there'll be a sort of a long sock on it that a yarn bomber
exactly.
would put there.
That's what it looks like.
So what are you standing up for there? Are you standing up for, I don't know, Mother Earth, for lambs, for wool, for sheep, for the handmade? What's the message?
What's the message? Yeah. I think that the message isn't so much related to the history of knitting or the things that you have been talking about. It's more just kind of part of the spontaneous art that has begun to happen, where people just go out into the street and sing Handel's Messiah, or they go out and suddenly do a dance performance. It's kind of asking people to just stop for a second and be surprised by what they're seeing, and that also their neighborhoods and their streets can belong to them more. I feel like the knitting kind of turns the street into a more pleasant living room.
Do you see people slowing or stopping and responding to your knit tags or yarn bombs?
Oh, yeah. I do it with a young woman who I call the Russian, and we usually do it during the day. And so people come and talk to us while we're doing it, and particularly little kids are really excited about it and go all over town looking for them.
Looking for evidence of your yarn bomb. That's great. Street Color, stand by there in Oakland. I want to get some more voices in here. Andrea in Nashville, Tennessee. Andrea, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
Yeah.
So there are thousands of ways to take this discussion, but I'm a mother and a grandmother and a nurse, a pediatric nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to touch a little bit about the benefits of teaching our children to create things with their hands, you know, knitting, crocheting, sewing. When we were young, we were taught to sew in home ec class, and generations ago, children knew that if you needed a sweater or socks, you had to make it, or someone had to make it. And kids, I don't think, realize that anymore. So I think there's a great benefit of teaching them that and showing them how to do it. And when they finish a project, it's like putting a puzzle together. They have to, it is an intellectual endeavor. They have to there are a number of steps they have to go through to create something, and when they do, they have something tangible to show for it. And my other thought just has to do with kind of from a neuroscience perspective, the benefits of teaching children to, you know, put two needles together and learn the stitches and make something. I think children with attention deficit or learning disabilities, or any child really, can benefit so much because all they really know how to do anymore is, you know, study their books, play sports, and go on their computers.
Maybe there's something fundamentally human that's missing, something that knitting brings there, Andrea.
Well, I think so. I think the it's not just creative. It is artistic, but it's also I think brain stimulating in the same way that learning an instrument, learning to play the piano is. There are connections that are made in the brain. I think when children are taught cognitive and motor skills at the same time.
Take that plastic brain, the plasticity of that brain, and really work with it. I think you're onto something there. Susan Strawn, it's interesting because you've looked back in history when knitting was just something that lots and lots and lots of people knew. It was second nature in a time when people did lots of handwork in the course of daily life. As Andrea points out now, for many children, that is not the case. It's funny how people are reaching back to hang on to something that was so humble in a way that, I mean, Andrea says, and it rings true, may be important actually to cultivating our, even developing our very physical brains today.
Yes, I certainly agree with that. I think for a long time there wasn't a choice. You had to do things by hand. You might be more, the wealthier families might be able to afford to have servants and so on knit for them, but Victorian era, it became a very genteel practice that showed you were a good wife and mother who could take care of their children. And as your caller was speaking, I was thinking about some of my students. One of the classes I teach in our fashion design program is a surface design class, and I have right now we have small classes, so it's about 10 students eager to learn to knit, and that's going to become part of the class. And the students have also started a knitting and crochet group. I think that the bringing some of the younger people, teenagers, high school students who have not had the advantage of learning this as they were small children, I certainly watch them struggle with it more than a small child would learning. So they have to be very motivated.
Jenna, I'm thinking of your daily work, Jenna, I think to make a living, you're a web designer. So you're going from a completely sort of digital world all day long and then home to your cold antler farm, sheep and wool and maybe some spinning and knitting. You know, what's the difference? Can you feel the different workout for your brain? Does it bring something different to your life?
Yeah, I have a desk job. I'm very stationary as a web designer. So to do the physical work of caring for the sheep is one form of workout. But whether you're farming or at a desk all day, it doesn't matter. We acquire so much stress. So to sit down in front of a favorite movie or have friends over or go to our local bookstore right in Cambridge has a knitting circle just a couple miles from my house. So there are ways to totally unwind, and whether it's letting go of work stress or office stress or a sore back from moving hay through 3 feet of snow, you get to decompress. And I think a lot of folks here agree that knitting is certainly a way to wind down.
Franklin, people get so wildly into it. My uncle, our cousin, I guess, older, has raised Cotswold sheep out in the Midwest. And you get flown out to the East Coast, people wanting to, you know, learn more about the wool and have a direct source for terrific wool. Bob Gillis, great guy, brought me actually my first lamb for my own flock there. But all the different wools people talk about having in their online conversations, the sort of stash of you name it. People have sort of their own libraries of yarn, I guess, from different sources of wool, Franklin.
Oh, absolutely. Stash is something that it's hard to avoid. When you're a knitter, I really don't know any knitter who doesn't have a pile of yarn waiting to be turned into something that frequently was purchased without a solid idea of what it was going to be. But we live in, we're in a golden age right now of what sorts of fibers are available to us and the sources that they come from. You can still buy from large companies, but you can also buy from a galaxy of extremely talented independent dyers and spinners. And that is one of the reasons that I think that knitting has survived the early fad, is that it just feels good to have this stuff run through your fingers. And you can find yarns now that are so unique that your piece is not only going to be beautiful and long-lasting because you've made it yourself, but also because the material it's made from is spectacular and gorgeous. When I first started knitting, the only yarn that I could find came from places like Woolworth. I used to go to the Woolworth at Downtown Crossing,
right.
and you know, buy $1.98 skeins of yarn. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, if you prefer to knit with blue-faced Lester yarn, you can. It's like buying varietal wines. You can now buy varietal yarns, and it's just spectacular.
Street Color, what's your next installation out in the San Francisco, Oakland area? What do you know yet, or what's the last one you put up?
Let's see. What I've been working on is putting yarn bombs in front of museums. So I've done the Young Museum and the San Francisco MoMA Museum and the Crocker Museum and the Cantor Art Museum.
You just knit a little bit of yarn right into the facade or the street out front?
No. I look around for a stop sign that's directly in front of the museum. And the pieces are really big. They're quite... I mean, they're like 8 or 9 feet tall.
Wow.
So they're not just like a little tiny knitted piece. And in doing that, I'm kind of asking the museum to consider that knitting can also be an art form. So I'm still working on that. And
that sounds pretty great. We're out of time right there, Street Color, and I'm sorry for it, but you've got it in the air and everywhere. Street Color in Oakland, California. Thank you for joining us today. And Jenna Wogenrich at Cold Antler Farm in Vermont, Manchester, Vermont, joining us today. Jenna, thank you. Franklin Habit in Chicago with the Panopticon. And Susan Strawn, Dominican University, author of Knitting America. Thanks to all. It's been great. This is On Point.